Welcome to Taproots. This is your host, Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. Today you're listening to my very first Taproots show on Heritage Radio Network. I'd like to thank our sponsor today, Fairway Market, featuring produce bought directly from the source, Fairway, like no other market. Well, first, a little bit about Taproots. On Taproots, we'll be digging deeply to explore America's growing local food movement and connect local family farmers, chefs, and foodies together, and to you, our listeners. Taproots will air at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every first Monday of the month. We'll be covering topics like eating and cooking seasonally, how to strengthen our local food economies community by community, how to grow and raise more of your own food, and who's out there making a difference in paving the way to a more sustainable and thoughtful way of living and eating on the planet. And please send me your ideas of what you'd like to hear more about or people you'd like to hear on my show. You may email me at Marla, that's M-A-R-L-A, Marla, at edibleaustin.com. Well, today we're going to focus on my home state of Texas and one of the culinary highlights of living here, Texas barbecue. But we're not here today to discuss what makes Texas barbecue better than, different from other styles from other regions, but rather to explore its roots and traditions, tell some barbecue tales, and track some trends. My first guest will be Elizabeth Engelhart, Southern food historian and author of the new book, Republic of Barbecue. Then we'll hear from three guests who are among the subjects featured in her book, Jonathan Pace of Smoky Denmark Sausage Company, Pat Marish of Ruby's Barbecue, and Ronnie Vinikoff, a wood purveyor and owner of Forestry Management Service in Rockdale, Texas. We'll pause here for a short break, and I'll be right back with our first guest in just a minute.
Guitar plays in the backyard singing. The tree limbs swinging. There's Big Daddy, he's about to have a fit, trying to get that charcoal lit. Everybody's laughing and falling to the knees, getting kind of hungry, calling out, please, just give me some peace. Barbecue.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to Taproots on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Fairway Market. Thanks so much for joining us. My first guest is Elizabeth Engelhart, associate professor of American Studies at the University of Texas and author of a new book, Republic of Barbecue. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you, Marla.
First off, what inspired you to make this book on barbecue, and how do you see it being different from so many of the other barbecue books out there?
Well, it is a bit different, and it has a long story of inspiration, which I'll make kind of short. We were here at the University of Texas going to have a class for grad students about American food, and as the professor of that class, I was just sitting in my office thinking that I really wanted a project that took place in the community so that we could have something to bounce the ideas that we were reading in class off of and to have the class make a little bit of a difference in the world. And as I was sitting in my office having those thoughts, my phone rang, and I got a cold call from someone who is now a really dear friend, but whom I had never talked to before, named Luke Zimmerman, who was the head of the Central Texas Barbecue Association, a little nonprofit in town that had, as part of their mission statement, the desire to collect some oral histories about barbecue. They didn't have the person power to or the skills to do it, and Luke found me through our friends over at Southern Foodways Alliance, and we had a really great conversation. And even at that moment, I don't think any of us dreamed that it would turn into a book, but once we started heading out into our great big community and really listening to the stories of barbecue, we just felt like there was more and more there. And we wanted to try and take a picture of Central Texas Barbecue. So we started with oral histories. We ended up with a website, and then we stepped back as a team, and we were no longer a class, but said, what else could this be? And that was the moment where the book project began.
Wow, that's very inspirational. And the book is wonderful. It's really, instead of focusing on, you know, recipes and who's got the best sauce or you know, what makes this barbecue book better than all the rest, it's all about the people. And it really tells the stories of where they've come from and what their role in barbecue is. And so tell us some of the things that sort of set Texas apart that you discovered through doing the book that sets Texas apart as far as the barbecue traditions go.
You know, it really is a story about the people. And I think one of the things that makes this book a little bit different is that we were really clear with everyone we talked to that we weren't ranking restaurants. We weren't trying to find out their deepest, darkest secrets, but that we were really interested in what they cared about and what was hard for them and what their hopes and dreams were and how their whole families participated. And we did that by not only talking to some of the folks who are the stars of barbecue in Texas, but also we wanted to look behind the scenes and around the edges. And so one of the things that we found is that even if you are not yourself actively eating barbecue in Texas, your life is in some way a part of this barbecue story. So as we talk to people who provide wood for the restaurants or who work as waitstaff in the restaurants or who make the sausages that later end up in the restaurants or make the sides from a great-grandmother's recipe, we found that Texas barbecue is a story of communities, and I think that's one of the things that's really distinctive. We also set off without an absolute definition of what counts as real, true, authentic barbecue because we wanted to see, well, what is being made and what's the range of it. So we talked to someone whose family has always made barbacoa because we wanted to find out what that cousin of Texas barbecue had contributed. We wanted to talk to people who make sausage in the German Czech tradition, but we also wanted to talk to some folks who make sausage in the Alsatian tradition. And so sausage is a big part of barbecue in Texas, but it turns out there's a lot of different kinds of sausages that are being made and a lot of different cultures and ethnicities that participate in that. We also found that when we even looked at the kind of star on the Texas barbecue plate of brisket, that there are real contributions from African-American cooks, from Hispanic cooks, from cooks in that German-Czech tradition, from former Appalachians like myself who have ended up in Texas. Not that I've had a big role in the brisket, but I have certainly tasted a lot of it and have found those kind of family roots in how the recipes develop. One other thing is that because barbecue in Texas is often more beef-based than it is pork-based, we could find religious diversity in barbecue here. So someone like Pat Marish, who's the partner of Luke Zimmerman, who was the head of the Central Texas Barbecue Association, is a Jewish barbecuer in Texas. Hmm. So when we just walked in and said, okay, do you call it barbecue? Do a few people agree? Can we talk to you? Then we found that what's distinctive about Texas barbecue is all the influences, all this kind of diverse mix of who's had a say.
So it's really a combination of a whole lot of different traditions.
It really is.
Another thing, Elizabeth, in your book, you feature a large number of women in the business of making barbecue. And, you know, barbecue is thought of as mostly a man's culinary domain, you know. And so how did you find so many women and decide to include them in the book?
Well, we were, when we committed to trying to take a picture of all of Central Texas barbecue, then we were able to use our critical eyes to say, well, who do we expect to find and who are we surprised to find? And so one of the things that after we had done 25 or so interviews, we stepped back to say was, look at this, there really are a lot of women participating in barbecue, but we have these ideas of, barbecue being a throwback to the caveman around the fire, that sometimes we forget that story. So one of the team members who absolutely wins the award for the best title of an essay in the book is our colleague Melanie Haupt, who wrote the essay called The Feminine Mesquite. And in that, she goes on and talks about how women in barbecue in Texas, some choose to be out front and be the face of the barbecue. Some are the actual pitmasters who are producing the barbecue every day and who are really in charge of it, but they choose sometimes not to be out front. And there's such a range of roles to play in both the restaurants and the sausage factories and the suppliers that women are really participating at all kinds of different levels and in all kinds of different jobs. We also found that many, many of those great grandmothers and aunts and favorite cook in the community who happen to be a woman contribute the recipes for the sides that are in barbecue in Texas.
Mm-hmm. And certainly it's such a family tradition too that you know it's funny that all along people haven't really given women their due in this tradition. But one of the things that I was going to ask you about as well is you talk about the team that put this book together. Can you talk about how many of your students participated and how did you actually go out and find all these places with them?
We talk about the project as being a big potluck, which I think is the best metaphor for it. We set a great big table. So there are actually 12 people on the title page of the book. We had a couple of other folks in the original class who were moving on to fantastic jobs in advertising and the like in New York City, who, ironically, you can't leave the Republic of Barbecue Project, apparently, because they helped us plan events up in New York City when we were launching the book. But from that group of 12 who's on the title page, there's also the 20 or 25 people who are in the oral histories telling their story in first person in the book. And one of the ways that we found them was by literally having potlucks where we asked people who would be interested in this project, who we had heard had an important story to tell, to come and talk to us and to make recommendations of other people we ought to interview. So we make no claims of it being a scientific sampling, and we know that we only scratch the surface. And in fact, we hope to continue doing interviews because it is such a big story in Texas. But we also let the interviews that we did gather additional ones for us. But we also had a moment where we stepped back and said, well, what else is a part of this story? And asking some of those questions is what led us to people like Ronnie Venikoff, who it turns out provides a lot of the wood to Central Texas, especially Austin barbecue restaurants, and manages 15,000 acres of land up in Rockdale, outside of Taylor, Texas, and has a really interesting story about how barbecue can be a part of environmental culture in Texas. So we wanted to keep ourselves open to the stories that were there and the stories that were recommended to us, but we also wanted to look around a little bit and see who else we could find.
Well, and I think that sense of discovery, that it's very much a feeling that you get from reading the book, is that you're discovering so many things about not just the people but and their own personal lives, but just the whole sum of the total is a beautiful discovery. I think that's what makes it really relevant to people outside of Texas, too. One of my questions was going to be, why should people who aren't in Texas, from Texas, want to read this book? Why would people want to seek it out and read it? And what would you say in addition to that?
Well, overall, I think that a book like this could be done in almost any community. And so I would be just thrilled if some people read this book and said, you know what, my community has a story about pecan pies that someone should capture, right? Or my community has a story about brisket, but we serve it on Sunday and we don't slow cook it. right? And we could capture that because I think when you look at this particular book, when you look at Republic of Barbecue, what you come away thinking is this is a story of families, it's a story of communities, it's a story of change, and we worked very hard to let it be a story that has its tensions as well as its joys, right? So some of that change is great, and some of that change has been hard. And over the course of doing this project, we had some places that went out of business. We had some folks who passed away, but we also interviewed some 20-year-olds who are just really fired up to enter this business and be a part of barbecue in Texas because they feel like it's a way to put down roots in the communities that they are either from or are joining. And those kind of stories, I think, are inspirational and are hidden but present in communities around the United States.
So it sounds like this project has a life beyond the book.
It does have a life beyond the book. We have a beautiful website that our friends at the Southern Foodways Alliance helped to set up. And if you go there, you can, in fact, listen to clips from all of the oral histories. So you have some voices to go with the faces that are in the book. We have
that's good. Tell us what the website, what the URL is.
Absolutely. It is republicofbarbecue.com. Spell barbecue with a C and spell it out. So it's all one word, republicofbarbecue.com. And you can also download the transcripts. One of the things that we did when we went back and started writing essays that we feel are just one more part of the conversation. They're not more important than the oral histories. They're not more important than the images that we have in the book. But they are just a way of us talking back to these really thoughtful stories that people told us. But one of the things that we knew when we started writing those essays is that there's so much more material in the oral histories that we've done so far and in the stories that other people can discover. So one part of the website is gives you a way to tell us what are the other stories that we need to go and find.
So it's a very interactive website, and it's that guarantees that you'll find more and more source material just as you did with your original oral history interviews.
That is our best dream for the project. That would be fantastic.
Oh, that's great. Well, we're very excited because we have a couple of three actually subjects from your book on the show today, and you already mentioned Ronnie Vinikoff, the Forest Management Service tree purveyor. We'll be talking with him later on in the show. Before that, we're going to talk to Jonathan Pace from Smoky Denmark Sausage Company. You mentioned how sausages are a big part of Texas barbecue, and he supplies and makes and supplies sausage to many of the restaurants and markets. And then also we'll be talking to Pat Marish, who started Ruby's Barbecue in Austin, and they have a really interesting history. So is there anything you'd like to say about either Smoky Denmark's or Pat before we move into our interviews with them?
Well, absolutely. One of the interesting things about Smoky Denmark's is that they are one of our little small sausage factories in Austin. They've been around for years and years, and they are really respectful of people's recipes. What do you want this to taste like? What do you want it to be like? They do a lot of talking back and forth with their customers to get it right. But at the same time, they're one of the most technologically advanced companies as well. So one of the stories you can ask Mr. Pace about is the wireless probes that track the temperature of the sausage through the production line. We got really fascinated by those wireless probes that communicate to a server in Dallas, and it's one of those symbols of how barbecue in Texas is connected to the past, but is also really connected to the future. So you have places like Smoky D's that just are a symbol of those connections. And Pat at Ruby's is another one of those new futures for barbecue in Texas because they're one of the places that is taken very seriously. The transition to finding grass-fed beef, finding beef that is more humanely produced, figuring out if there can be a kind of environmentally sensitive barbecue in Texas. And that's a work in progress, but that's one of the things that people are starting to really talk about and pay attention to.
Well, that's I think that means a lot, especially to our listeners on this show. I know that we're going to be excerpting part of your book for our summer issue of Edible Austin. And so for our readers there also, that we really do want to find ways to make the food we eat more meaningful and more thoughtful and more sustainable. And since barbecue does involve a great deal of meat, the idea of humanely harvested and processed and healthfully raised beef and meat and pork is just so important to us. So that's great that came out in the book, too. So, Elizabeth, I wanted to thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, Marla, thank you so much. And on behalf of the rest of the team, we're all just thrilled to have this kind of conversation. And, hey, it's
great. Are you doing a book tour?
We are. We have been in a few places around the country, and we're looking forward to spring, which is when barbecue season gets going again. So that's when we'll be out and about. Unfortunately, I don't have anything big to announce right now, but we are always interested in showing up to talk about barbecue, whether it's a cold place or a hot place.
Great. And again, you can go to republicofbarbecue.com to check out the whole project.
Absolutely. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well, and there are links from the website to get us there.
Terrific. Thanks so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Marla. Have a great day.
Thank you. I'd like to thank our sponsor once again, Fairway Market. Fairway features produce that's bought directly from the source. And we're going to take a short break and be back with our next guest, Jonathan Pace.
I told you, Mama, ain't gonna tell you no more. I told you, Mama, ain't gonna tell you no more. You better have my barbecue everywhere you go. I bought your pepper, I bought your salt, I went to work in my overhaul. Come back home, lying on the door, say bye-bye daddy, I can't use you no more.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to Taproots on Heritage Radio Network, and this show is brought to you today by Fairway Market. Thanks so much for joining us. My next guest is Jonathan Pace, the owner of Smoky Denmark Sausage Company, one of the featured barbecue businesses in Elizabeth Engelhardt's book, Republic of Barbecue. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you, Marla. Thanks for having me.
Sure. It's our pleasure. This has been a really fun show so far, talking to Elizabeth about the book and then being able to have the subjects come alive on the radio show here. So tell us a little bit about the history of Smoky D's and how you came to own it and run it.
Well, there really was a Smoky Denmark. He started learning to make sausage by some of the legendary guys down in Central Texas, and back in 1964, he decided to open up his own sausage company, and he did that in Austin, in East Austin, and ran the company and did a great job making sausage. And then in 1972, Jim McMurtry and Cliff Laywell bought out Mr. Denmark and continued to make sausage in the same tradition that Mr. Denmark did, and really successfully grew the company and, providing product for the Austin and Central Texas markets. And then in 1999, I had a chance to, myself and my wife, buy out Cliff Laywell, the partner, and we really grew quite a bit, and me and Jim both very successful and growing the markets and making some neat products for Central Texas markets and throughout Texas.
So, and the partnership you had with Jim McMurtry, I believe he's your father-in-law, or was your father-in-law. Unfortunately, he passed away about a year ago. Did he bring a lot of the new technology on board with the company, or did you guys do that together?
We kind of did that together. We
talk a little bit about Jim.
Yeah, you know, Jim, you know, loved to make things and loved to, you know, bake, and he was really a good cook. And you know, he had some great ideas. And one of the things that we needed to do was really to, you know, leverage new technology and to help us really make good food, good products that were safe and that we could make consistent. That was one of the things that we really wanted to do, was to continually to make consistent product that people enjoyed. The people at restaurants that go in and eat our sausage, we want that product to be the same every time that they eat it, and that they enjoy it and they like to come back to the restaurant.
So, and that talks to another thing, too, that in the interview, in the book, it's Elizabeth interviews Jim McMurtry, and he talks about how Smoky Denmark's sausages are made in batches instead of, you know, continuous production, and that quality is really paramount, and that you still traditionally smoke your meats, and that some of these traditional ways of making sausage for mass markets, and you do sell to a lot of restaurants and markets, I understand, have kind of gone away, but that it's very important to you to keep that going.
That's right. We call it really traditional methods. You know, we still smoke with hickory on our sausage. We source the hickory sawdust from East Texas, and we use post oak split wood for all our pit smoked briskets and ribs and things like that. And, you know, we really like to call that traditional methods, because there is a lot of, you know, product these days that, you know, because of mass production, they could use liquid smoke and different things like that. But we like to try to use the traditional, you know, smoke, so to speak, that, you know, just gives that great flavor. And plus, it's still kind of handcrafted.
Mm-hmm.
But additionally, you know, there's a lot of things also that we've, you know, tried to do, which is, you know, food safety is very important. And one of the things that we, you know, really strive to do is be more proactive instead of reactive when it comes to food safety. And, you know, having systems in place that monitor temperatures in every batch, and all our rooms are all tied into a system that, you know, takes temperature every 2 seconds. And anytime that there's a temperature that's out of norm, we get text messages on our phones, and we can react to that real quickly. So, you know, being proactive on food safety is very important to us as well.
Yeah, and Elizabeth was talking about that a little bit in our first interview, about how you have the wireless probe, and it sends information all the way to Washington, D.C.?
Well, we have a system called FreshLock that every product, every batch that you mentioned, has a probe inserted into the product, and it measures the temperature and time throughout its whole life cycle of cooking and stabilization, which is the chilling of the product after it's cooked, to make sure that, you know, the product is safe to eat. And we can record that temperature, or the temperature is recorded every 2 seconds. So we have data on each batch through its whole life cycle, and we can go back and look at that and make sure that the product, you know, met its lethality and stabilization requirements, because we're federal inspected, obviously, and we, you know, we want to make sure that we have good data that we can take a look and make sure every batch is exactly how we want it to come out.
Right. And do you, as far as your recipes, do you work with recipes from your customers pretty much, and do you have your own recipes as well, or how do you create your products?
Primarily, we usually develop our own recipes. We have some customers that maybe that will bring a recipe that they would like us to develop. And but primarily, we like to develop things. That was the neat thing about being in the sausage business. You know, me and Jim were both, he was an attorney, I was an accountant. But I grew up in a restaurant family, and always back in the kitchen. And when we had a chance to get back into this business, you know, it was really fun to be able to create things. And that's one of the things that we like to do, is really get out there and create new products that people enjoy, and that we also get feedback from them that they enjoy the products that we create.
And so who are some of your favorite customers? I know that's kind of hard to ask, because I'm sure you love them all, but what's the range of and the kinds of customers that you sell to?
Yeah. Well, we, you know, in this day and age, in this economy, we look, you know, we really appreciate all our customers. And, it's, you know, there's some, you know, we have some, we have, you know, down to the street vendors on 6th Street here in Austin that we really like, you know, like Austin Best Worst. He's a streetcar vendor, but we also really enjoy our relationships with medium-sized companies like the Rudy's barbecue chain. Mm-hmm. But we also do business with companies like Jason's Deli, which are national. And they, you know, every different size company has their, you know, their interesting things about them. You know, Jason's, one of the things that they're doing is really moving towards clean labeled products. And, you know, that's something that's, you know, been a challenge for the industry to start really starting to clean up the products that, you know, the ingredients that are in the products. And that's something that I think that, you know, important to your radio listeners.
Absolutely. So I met one of your customers recently, and she's wonderful. It's Leslie Horn who makes the or sells the has created the product that's a Spanish style chorizo.
That's right. We love that product.
Oh, it's wonderful, and I can't say enough about it. And I know in our conversation we were talking about how she has been talking to you about finding ways to go nitrate free.
That's
and with the current demand, or are you seeing a demand for more natural ways of preserving meats and for products like that? And are you looking at that as a possible direction?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that. I just spent a whole week about 3 weeks ago up at Iowa State University, and they have a really good meat science department, and they have really good short courses that you can go to. And one of the things that was really a predominant issue there or item was this naturally cured products and really moving towards clean labeled, you know, meats, you know, cured meats mm-hmm. now that can be naturally cured. And there's really, that's one of the things that we're working on with Aurelius Chorizo is the opportunity to create some products that by using things like celery powder and things to help, you know, because celery powder has some natural nitrite in it.
And really? Naturally occurring?
Yeah, naturally occurring. So it allows us to be able to use that, and it doesn't have the same concentrations that you typically would have with typical cured products.
Hmm.
So it's definitely something, it really took up a lot of, you know, there was a lot of time spent on that in class, and there's a lot of interest in that. And so what we're trying to do is start to develop more products like that and also have clean labels. One of the things that we...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can you just explain what you mean by clean labels?
Well, for instance, you know, there's a lot of people sometimes put preservatives like a potassium sorbate or something to preserve freshness.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we're trying to do, like with, for instance, we have a beer brat that we make that we use Live Oak beer, which is a local brewery. And what we try to do is use fresh ingredients and keep from having to put a lot of chemicals in the product to extend shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we want to do is for people to enjoy it at its peak freshness. So really the shelf life is really short on these products, but they're intended to because they're fresh and they don't have a lot of chemicals added to it.
So that's definitely a direction that you're moving towards, it sounds like, and it sounds great. That's something I'd love to see more companies take on.
Well, yeah, in years past, you know, there wasn't all these chemicals that we're putting in the products. It was a lot fresher, you know, like you were talking about sustainability and local sourcing of products. You know, people brought the ingredients in here locally, and they made it there, and they sold it to local customers. I think there's a lot of, growing demand for that.
Well, thank you, Jonathan, so much for being with us today, and good luck with the company. And I'm hope that we've gotten some new customers for you by having you on the show.
Thank you very much.
I really like you're very much respected and loved in this community, and I appreciate your spending some time with us today.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a short break, then we'll be back with our next guest, Pat Marsh of Ruby's Barbecue.
Pepper, I bought you salt. I went to work in my overhaul. Come back home, lying on the door. Say bye-bye, Daddy, I can't use you no more. Now tell me, good baby, would you give my barbecue to? barbecue chicken, barbecue ham, barbecue beef, barbecue lamb. When you fix that table for me, make it plain barbecue just as sweet as can be. Now tell me, good mama, would you give my barbecue too? I'm a poor, poor boy, and a long, long way from home. I'm a poor, poor boy, and I'm a long, long way from home. And don't doubt me, baby, and please don't do me wrong. When I was a boy.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to Taproots on Heritage Radio Network, and our show today is brought to you by Fairway Market, featuring produce brought directly from the source. My next guest is Pat Marish, who, along with her husband Luke, founded Ruby's Barbecue, another featured barbecue business in Elizabeth Engelhart's book, Republic of Barbecue. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Hey, hi, Marla.
Thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Pat, what inspired you and Luke to open a barbecue restaurant back in the late 80s in Austin?
Well, we both had been interested in food and were a little bit of foodies prior to that, and both enjoyed cooking and had worked at restaurants, and were just really wanting to do something to kind of get out on our own, be our own bosses, that kind of thing, and started looking around. I come from a farming background and grew up, basically we had in Nebraska, and so we had cows, pigs, geese, chickens, you know, the whole thing, and obviously crops that we grew there, and grew up with that and with cooking. I have come from a Czech family on both sides, and so we did a lot of cooking. And so both of us were looking at getting, you know, staying in the food industry and opening our own place. We had been talking to some friends about it and trying to figure out exactly what to do, and the consensus was, being in Texas at that time, that we should do something regional and go with barbecue. Plus, there was quite a resurgence of blues in Austin at that time in the late 80s. We opened up in the fall of 88, and a location came up next to Antone's Blues Club, and we figured blues and barbecue was a good mix. So that's sort of how it all came about.
So from the very beginning, you sort of were, you're tied at the hip with the music scene in Austin.
Absolutely. And, of course, we were open until midnight initially, and the club obviously was open till 2 a.m., and they used to give some plugs for us. Another thing about the location that we liked was just up the street was the Austin Chronicle newspaper, which is a weekly here in Austin, Texas. And they're huge fans of barbecue, so we figured we'd get some business built in from them. So that all kind of worked. But we, as a result, we got very close to the people at Antone's and a lot of the blues people. Particularly, they featured a lot of the Chicago bluesmen and from the Delta and then Louisiana and Texas area. And after about 6 to 8 months on the weekend, we started staying open until 4 a.m.
Oh,
to accommodate
goodness.
Their crowds and their staff.
So a lot of the, not only the guests from the shows at Antone's, but the actual bluesmen and the musicians themselves would come over and eat there?
Yes, definitely. And a lot of people might be familiar with the owner, Clifford Antone, who's from Port Arthur, Texas. And he became a close friend and would come over here, kind of host his friends on Fridays and Saturday evenings and stay and shut us down. A frequent visitor was Albert Collins. Every time he played, he was over, and he was just, you know, great soul, big heart. And the Fabulous Thunderbirds were doing pretty well at that time and quite well known, and to this day, like just yesterday, in fact, Kim Wilson was here in town, and he stopped by, and we visited for a while. And Jimmy Vaughn is here locally, Stevie Vaughn's brother, and we see quite a bit of him yet. But in the late 80s, of course, and early 90s, you would see Buddy Guy and Sammy Myers and Pine Top Perkins, Snooky Pryor, and a lot of those guys, of course, have passed on. So the blues scene has kind of changed, and Antone's moved in 95 or 96. So
mm-hmm.
That's somewhat changed, but we still do have a relationship with them and still do food for Maceo Parker and some other blues groups, and they still come visit us when they're in town.
Well, and you have a wonderful reputation in town for just the best barbecue. And part of that, I think, is that it's been such a lively and fun place because of the ties with the music scene here. But another reason is that from very early on, you've used natural meats in your barbecue dishes. And that's hard to find, or it certainly was hard to find. I think it's getting maybe a bit easier. But what made you decide to go that route?
I appreciate the compliment. Thank you, Marla. But how we got turned on to the all-natural beef was that there, about two blocks from us, there is a grocery store, a co-op, Wheatsville Co-op, and they approached us. The deli supervisor approached us that first winter. We opened in November, and probably already by January, she approached us to see if we might want to buy their beef briskets. They were carrying all-natural beef. It was B3R, the Bradley 3 Ranch out of Childress, Texas. And as is common for delis, they would purchase half a cow or, you know, a whole side and packages, and a brisket was one piece of the package. But in the wintertime here in Texas, they were not able to sell the brisket. Most people were barbecuing outside in the summertime. Mm-hmm. So we started buying briskets individually from them, and we were just so impressed with the flavor and the texture, the way it picked up the smoke from our pits. And so we contacted B3R as a result of that and worked out a distributorship where they would deliver to us once every 2 weeks. So that's really how we got started, and we were with them as long as they were in business, and we were just, like I said, very pleased with the product. We weren't sure how well that was going to go over because late 80s in Austin was not a good time economically, and we had tried to keep our costs down as low as we could. And obviously, with the all-natural beef, we had to charge a little more. But enough people recognize that we've been able to maintain that.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gone kind of through different suppliers as B3R sold to Coleman, and they sold to Myers. And actually, I'm just experiencing now in the last month a situation of brisket shortage that I've not seen in the 21 years we've been open. I've called two of our suppliers, and both of them told me they have no briskets for us and will not have briskets till the end of March.
Is that right?
So I'm not sure exactly what's going on in the market, but apparently even the briskets, regular briskets, IBPs and that, their prices, everything's going up in the last month. So
that's interesting.
So for now, but I'm hoping
hopefully that'll shift back. Do you find that do you see a trend, or do you see more people asking for natural meat or grass-fed or any of the more sustainably raised? Meat is such a big part of barbecue, and so many people are getting more aware of, you know, knowing where their meat comes from and wanting to make sure it's the healthiest they can get and tastiest that way, and, you know, sustainably raised. So are you seeing more people questioning that now or not so much?
I definitely think there is, there is more of a trend in that direction, which I'm really happy to see. We have a few more people asking about it, a few more people that seem to be aware of it. It's amazing sometimes how many people don't realize it. They've been eating with us for years, and one day they say, oh, I didn't know you had all natural beef. But I have had more people inquiring about grass-fed, and I would love to carry local and grass-fed. Couple issues with that at the moment, of course, is going to be price, because it would, I don't know, we're near the University of Texas and have some students eat with us, and I'm just not sure how much more we could be asking for price-wise. Plus, locally, they just could not supply our needs. We need too many briskets a week, and there isn't any supplier that could handle that right now. But I'm hoping that's moving in a direction where that would change, prices come down and supplies go up.
Well, you know, one of the big problems is producing the meat and going through the production system. And for local ranchers, it's really a severe problem. We have a story about that in this current spring issue of Edible Austin, how difficult it is to get locally, to get meat to market and to get it butchered and processed
right,
in a sustainable way and, you know, quickly and all of that. And it's just the business is dominated by large manufacturers, and it's really hard for the smaller ranches and farmers to get their products through, especially during hunting season. It's difficult. So I know that it's really a problem right now, and that's something that we're all working on, at least recognizing so that we can find solutions for that. But back to the menu, I was wondering, you know, I was talking to Elizabeth a little bit about this in the earlier interview today. But barbecue is sort of thought of as a male-dominated business, and so you've been a very strong example of a wonderful female barbecue chef. And I was wondering, do you think it's affected your menu or what you make and what you serve at Ruby's?
You're saying being a woman in the barbecue business?
Yeah, well, and more than just in your case being a woman, you have a pretty strong culinary background too. Interest in different ethnic cuisines and
right, boy, that's hard to say. I guess definitely, obviously, we've always wanted to stick with the homemade product. There are so many barbecue places. In fact, probably the majority that use cans and cartons. But I don't know. I guess we wanted to get away maybe from just a set small menu. So we've expanded desserts. Our desserts are homemade. Inspired that part of our menu, and we added, you know, salads and Cajun food. And I don't know, I guess that might come from a background where I've cooked a lot.
And you guys have a pit there on site?
We have a what?
A pit?
Yes, we have two brick pits that we modeled after the pits in Lockhart from Crisis. And we had one was built just before we opened, and then within a year, in order to produce enough and to smoke enough to meet demand, we had to build another pit, a little larger one outside. But on the brick pits, you can't smoke. What's one of the problems is you can't really do the volume that you can, like on big rotisserie pits.
Right, right.
But I think the product is really good, and the smoking definitely the flavor comes through a little differently.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that kind of leads us to our next guest, too, because Ronnie Vinikoff is one of the main suppliers, I think, of wood to fire up those pits all over Texas.
Yes, he is.
And you're a customer of his, are you not?
Yes, we've been with Ronnie for many, many years. When we first opened, we would look in the paper and look around and try to figure out where we're going to get wood for our pits. And then I don't remember exactly how we got acquainted with Ronnie and lickety-split, but we've been with him ever since, and he's been a real steady supplier, so it's been great.
Well, that's great. And we're going to talk to Ronnie about, you know, how he is a good environmental steward of the forests that he cultivates and culls for the pits. So, Pat, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
You're located in Austin, Texas, and I know for those listeners in Austin, they already know about you, but for those who are planning visits to Austin, I can highly recommend going to Ruby's Barbecue. So thanks, Pat.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We're going to take a really quick little break and get Ronnie on for the next interview.
Okay. I told you, Mama, ain't gonna tell you no more. I ain't gonna tell you no more. You better have my barbecue everywhere you go. I bought your pepper, I bought your salt.
Welcome back. This is Marla Camp, publisher of Edible Austin and member of Edible Communities. You're listening to Taproots on Heritage Radio Network, and our show today is brought to you by Fairway Market. Fairway, like no other market. My next guest is Ronnie Vinikoff, who spends a great deal of his time out in the woods, hunting and fishing and managing many, many acres, I think 15,000 or more acres of trees and forests that provide the essential fuel for Texas barbecue. Welcome to the show, Ronnie.
Thank you.
Was I right about that number of acreage?
It kind of goes up and down. It's supply and demand. We're kind of trying to be as efficient as today as possible to be with the economy. So we've kind of let a few leases go, but we kind of keep some on standby that we can lease as the need arises. It's millions and millions of dollars worth of property that there's no way I could afford to own.
Right.
So like I said, so we have to kind of lease it from the landowners to keep it, and it's kind of an ethical investment on our part We help landowners that wouldn't be able to do improvements to the land, and we do improvements to the land in exchange for a vest in the futures of the timber.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of complicated, but every deal is different. We just have to negotiate the best deal that we can with the landowner to try to keep our costs down and pass that on to our customers and still be sustainable.
Right.
And take care of the environment, too.
Well, how much, can you give us some idea of like how much wood it takes to run all the barbecue businesses in Texas? I mean, are you the only supplier or a main supplier or?
There was a time probably in the height of my career that I probably had an 85% share of the market in the Austin area.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that I probably have, it's probably about 45% now, just because Austin has grown. And we
mm-hmm.
haven't been able to grow, you know, and sustain that 85% in a sustainable way. And there's, you know, like I say, the economy has gotten bad, and a lot of people just aren't willing to pay what it costs. Like I say, it's an ethical investment on the customer's part to be able, you know, because what we do, it costs more to do it this way. You know, we're not out just trying to, you know, if I was trying to be the cheapest one, I'd be out clear cutting.
Right.
Like
we'll talk a little bit about that because you are an environmentalist.
You know.
And so tell us, you know, what that means in the way that you run your business, you know, of managing the forest.
Like I say, I just, you know, it's all about educating and bringing awareness because a lot of people just, they don't have any idea. They just think, you know, they can just pick up the phone and it just magically appears. You know, it takes years and years for these trees to grow, and they grow so little each year. But through our management, we can kind of speed up that process. And like I said, we do soil samples, and we learn what the nutrients in the soil are lacking so that the trees are growing at their optimum, and we replenish that. This past year has been kind of tough with the drought, you know, and I wish we're in the process of maybe putting in about a 10-acre lake and parts of the property so that we can maybe irrigate out of that in dry times. But for the most part, most of our land is, it's got a lot of springs on it, so it's pretty low ground,
mm-hmm.
bottom land, which is real good, you know, for the trees because it does take a lot of water. It's a lot of science to it, behind it all, just to be able to produce. And to give you
Well, and tell us why that's important to you. You talk about ethical management of the trees and the land.
I didn't catch what you said.
Tell us why that's important to you, managing this in an ethical way.
I'm just very passionate about the environment. You know, I just think that it needs to be done. It's just something. It's the reason I get up and do this every day. I just can't get up. I can't wait to get up and go to work and being out there. It's something that we need to preserve for future generations. You know, it's just. Without trees, you know, we're doomed. You know, the world needs the forest. You know, for the
mm-hmm.
oxygen, to clean the air, the water, everything. There's just no other way to do it any more, you know, efficiently than Mother Nature.
Well, and I think a lot of people don't think about it, but when you know you're making food in all of these barbecue pits, it requires a lot of wood. To
right.
smoke, and it's a long process smoking the wood or smoking the meats and on top of everything. So it really is a resource that you could run out of if it wasn't managed in an
exactly.
environmentally
exactly.
appropriate way.
It's not unlimited, that's for sure.
So it's a goal to keep all of the land that you're leasing for your management company is to keep it always in planted with trees. I mean, it's always going to
yeah.
have.
Yes.
More trees on it, on into the future.
Right. It's to keep certain kinds of trees. Like there are some areas of land that have certain kinds of trees that aren't very good, and we remove those and put trees that are better, trees that will regenerate on their own without having to be planted. Because the type of trees that we grow, it does not kill these trees to cut them down. They
mm-hmm.
will grow back, and they grow back faster.
What kind of trees are those?
Because the root system becomes more and more mature, and like I say, that's just the way to do it. You know, it's the best.
Ronnie, what kind of trees are those that you grow mostly for barbecue?
There, it's like a white oak, species of post oak, and they say it's second to none for the flavor of barbecue. And it seemed like that's the tree of choice for most of the people who the consumers, the restaurants that want to use that.
Well, Jonathan Pace, when we were talking to him earlier from Smoky Denmarks, was saying that a lot of the smoking comes from that kind of wood.
I'm kind of losing. I'm not getting a real good connection here. I didn't catch what you said.
I was just saying that I've heard that's the kind of wood of choice for most pit masters.
Right. And like I say, it just happens to be a tree that will regenerate if taken care of. If it doesn't come back, if we cut a tree, one of those trees down, and it doesn't come back, that means something was wrong with it. It either had some kind of disease or was on its way out. It was dying.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that.
How do you find your customers? How do people find you?
Mostly it's just referrals. You know, I have such a large share of the market. Sometimes people just get on the phone and start asking around, and my name just comes up. You know.
And how far do you distribute your wood to? How far do you sell? What just central area, central Texas, just Austin, or
yes, just in the central Texas area?
Uh-huh.
We try to stay within an hour's drive of where the forest is, just to kind of keep costs down. But there's some times that we do go as far as San Antonio, but it varies. Like I say, we pick up some customers and we lose some customers, and just as time goes on. But for the most part, if we ever lose a customer once, it doesn't take them long to get them back. And most time, once they're trying to cut corners and trying to cut costs, and especially these days with the economy. But they find out that it's a pretty good deal. You know, we're pretty competitive, and as far as the service and the quality, and the main thing that I sell is the sustainability. You know, we're still going to be here 40 years from now, where other people probably won't be, because our harvest rate does not exceed the growth rate, and we're growing more than what we're harvesting, and we will always be that way. I will never harvest more than what we're growing.
Well, that's the true definition of sustainable, and I think it's wonderful that you can find barbecue businesses that are using locally grown and sourced and managed resources like the wood that they need from you. So thank you for what you're doing, and thank you so much, Ronnie, for being on the show.
Thank you for letting me share this with you and bring the awareness that needs to be.
Great. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. So I want to thank our guests again today. This has been a great show. We've really enjoyed hearing all about barbecue and the people behind it and how it's part of a growing local and sustainable cuisine. That sort of started that way traditionally, and I think it's finding new directions for that now. So thank you all for listening to Tap Roots on Heritage Radio Network, and I'd like to thank our sponsor, Fairway Market, for making this show possible. I'll be back on Monday, April 5th, for my next Tap Roots show. I look forward to hearing from you in the meantime. So please email me at marla@edibleaustin.com with your thoughts and ideas for what you'd like to hear on Tap Roots.